Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and I just want to thank you for joining the Dr. Drew podcast and supporting the Corolla Pirate Ship here at the Corolla Network. And please, just a reminder, tell a friend about these podcasts. That is how this thing grows organically, and that is how we want this to grow. We want it to be a community of people that connect, and we talk about interesting things. And by the way, feel free to give us feedback and stuff, particularly for my show, that you'd like to hear. We'll be happy to set it up on the program. And again, tell a friend and keep this pirate ship afloat.
This is Corolla Digital.
And welcome to the Dr. Drew Podcast. Before we start out, just a reminder to check out The Boy with the Gun by Brandon Stogsdale. And of course, these swinging sounds you're getting a taste of right here, all on the website at drdrew.com, as well as clicking through at amazon.com and supporting our friends that keep the pirate ship afloat here. So, Bob Forrest joins me, first of all. Welcome.
Welcome to you. It's a good Sunday.
Yeah, it's good to have you back. Bob and I are by ourselves for a second. We were supposed to be joined by Dwight Doc Gooden.
I saw him last night.
Now, he will be here any second. We're having kind of a scheduling thing where he's en route, and he's literally – oh, there was an oil spill on the freeway. That's what's keeping him back. Okay. Well, so we have scheduling stuff. So Bob and I are just going to chat, and then when Doc gets here, we will include him in the conversation. His book is Doc, A Memoir. It's available. Click through at Amazon. Also, a link will be available at drdrew.com. His Twitter handle is at Doc, D-O-C, Gooden, G-O-O-D-E-N, 16. Was 16 his number?
Yes.
Dr. Gooden, 16. So – did you read his book? Did you see what he said about treatment stuff in his book?
I haven't seen it. I got to see it. I thought he'd give me one, but he didn't.
Well, he'll probably bring one in here. You'll see. He was very complimentary. It was very similar, frankly, to what other people have written about who felt like this was an important experience for them. Celebrity Rehab, I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think that he told me that he was watching it for a couple of years and wanted to be on it. And thought, if I get on there, maybe something would be different. You didn't know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how was it different for him? I guess I'll ask him when he gets here. But
I think one of it is being public about it and you know, that secrecy that goes on about rehab world.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That and the other thing that I'll be interested to hear if he says this, but to me, he had so much shame about his addiction. To be honest about the shame and then to come clean about that as well to his kids. So that's one son particularly.
Yeah.
I thought that was very important.
It's big. I asked him about his older son last night. But one of the things that I think he also thought was, I've been around Doc a lot in the last 4 years since he left the show, and people kiss his ass anywhere he fucking goes.
Wow.
It's unbelievable. So I
Is
think
that good
that
or
probably,
bad?
Bad.
Yeah.
I think that probably was how rehab was for him too.
Oh,
especially when he's the greatest.
But that rehab that outpatient program he was in was sort of the low end of the low.
Yeah, they mandatory to be there. But the people he'll tell you, when he realized people were staying longer in treatment so they could hang out with him at the smoke breaks.
Wow.
That's how – you forget, 24-3, I believe he was in 1985. Can you look that up?
He was a big
24-3 at 20 years old.
But forget the fact that he was a big deal. I just find it bizarre that people would – adjust the progress of their treatment.
No, but sports heroes are different. Remember when Dennis Rodman said sports heroes
No, he said, here's Dennis. We were in a group one
day. Dennis Rodman said the greatest thing about sports heroes in America.
We were trying to get him to, this is really funny. It's in group. We were trying to get him engaged in group. And he goes, no, you understand. I go, what don't understand, Dennis? Come on, tell me. You understand. There's God. There's sports figures. And then there's everyone else. He goes, you understand, I'm different.
And it was true. He goes, I've had three presidents kiss my ass.
Well, and now, and a North Korean,
dictator,
exactly.
Yeah, right.
24-11 in 1985.
So there's something about sports heroes, above musicians, above actors, above anything, that men become like little boys around. I saw it last night.
Wow.
I was I told you this Andy Koufax thing. I'm like, Andy Koufax. For whatever reason. You've got that about football players.
I got a little bit of awe, but not that kind of where I told you the story.
Who was your favorite football player that you modeled your game after?
Joe Green.
Mean Joe Green and Dr. Drew.
So, that's a good one. But listen to this. Well, I was a defensive end. What are you going to do? That wasn't when a guy on my side can play defensive end. I was quick. Yeah. I was quick off the ball.
Did you hit people on the side of the helmet?
No, I just was so damn slow but quick. You understand? If I could beat anybody to the backfield. No wow. problem. It was ridiculous. But if they took two steps
mean
away
Joe
from me.
Green.
Hang on a second. If they took two steps away from me, I was done. The play was over
oh, yeah.
for me.
Yeah, so, if they go around you.
Two steps. Probably fine. But if I got to them before they took a couple steps, I was fine. But here's the.
You ever met Mean Joe Green?
No. Is he still.
He's still around.
But here's it. But I don't. That wouldn't do that much for me. I had an interaction with Kobe the other day. Did I tell you about this?
No.
Oh, yeah. Somebody gave me courtside. You know, occasionally we get the blessed with courtside.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Which, by the way, how different is that than heroin?
It's
not very much,
not
is it?
Very much.
Okay.
Sorry. Except for I was courtside for the two final Lakers playoffs games. It was pathetic.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody wanted to go. Oh. That's why I got tickets.
Oh, God. Courtside. Well, anyway, to me, it was like, it's one of those things I wish I'd never done because nothing will ever be the same for me than basketball. But the last time I was there was that Raptor game they won in overtime that Kobe just willed into a win.
Yeah.
And just before he made the last basket, there's a timeout. He's walking across the court, and he gives me this, the chin thing. And I was like, I'm looking behind me. Like, who's he talking to? And he comes over and goes, we got to chit-chat about Jody Arias.
Oh, my God.
So funny. And then he called me.
Holy moly.
Yeah, couldn't be a better guy. Could not be a – really – really, I mean, you could tell. I don't know what people say about him in terms of their complaints. I think he's just a fierce competitor.
He's just obsessed.
You know, we know people.
The question is, what is he going to do after basketball?
I wouldn't worry about it. I think he's going to be fine. He's smart. He's personable, really personable. And whatever stuff he gets into, I'm sure it's about competition, about being competitive and fierce and ruthless.
That's Elvis's idol, Kobe. He has a picture of him on his wall. And he says, you know, because he got hurt, Elvis's thing is, you say to him, where's Kobe? At home. What's wrong? He got a bobo. His mommy's taking care of him.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah.
That's really
cute.
That's
my little daily dose of my little son, Elvis. So anyways, I do believe that people are ridiculously fanatical about their sports heroes.
Yep.
I myself am that way about Sandy Koufax. Very few people, but Sandy Koufax, for sure. And so sports heroes go into a rehab, and we'll have to talk to Dwight about this. Does everybody, including the staff, all the other patients, different than even if it's Lindsay Lohan or another celebrity? Sports heroes are different. I believe that. You don't?
No, I don't have enough. I'm just thinking about it. I'm thinking about rock stars I've seen in treatment. I'm thinking about movie stars I've seen in treatment. And
the musicians are open. Actors are kind of weirdos to begin with. But the sports people I've dealt with are very closed off. I don't even think they know the truth.
Because
they've lived in this
so
bubble
young.
For
yeah, so
such
young.
A long time. And they never get out of it. You know, rock stars at 35 ain't no more.
Right.
You're going to have to figure something else out. Actors, actresses in particular, 32, you're gone. You know, some actors survive, but most, you know, had a show or didn't have a show. But they come back down to earth.
Yeah.
For some reason, our sports heroes never have to come back down to earth.
Well, and when you say sports heroes, you're not just talking about really important athletes. You're talking about legendary heroes.
Yeah.
That stuff. Yeah, I suppose you're right. I mean, when you think
about it. Well, the two we've dealt with, Dennis and Doc, are pretty up
there.
Well,
it'd be interesting to talk to somebody like a Sandy Koufax who doesn't seem like he – well, Sean Green was in here. You remember Sean Green?
Oh, yeah.
Sean did not let it get to him.
He's steered clear of it?
Well, he'll talk about that experience, about being in the bubble and stuff. You guys remember the Sean Green episode? I did a thing just with me and then again with Adam also. He's a healthy, good guy. He comes to term with life on life's terms as it changes. He doesn't continue to cling through some sense of himself that is, you know, that he understands is false.
But are the people clinging to it, or are the athletes clinging to it, or are all of us in every restaurant they go to and every movie theater they attend any rehab they go to, are we reinforcing who they were?
How about Jabbar? Do you think he insists on that kind of
– He insisted on that statue.
Which one?
The one out in front of Staples Center. You know about that?
right?
Episode 32 with Sean Green.
Yeah, I heard they just put it up just to shut him up.
That's what I heard, too.
Bitching and bitching. So annoying.
About what?
Kareem felt like he didn't get his just respect.
Yeah.
That he's the greatest scorer of all time, greatest rebounder of all time. There's a picture, there's statues of Wayne Gretzky, Magic Johnson, and Chick Hearn.
Oscar De La Hoya is up
there. He's got a point.
Why isn't Will Chamberlain up there?
Yeah, there
isn't
you go.
Will Chamberlain, was he, if he were alive, he'd probably be insistent.
No, he'd just be with the bitches.
Oh, he's so funny. All right, so let's talk about how this interfaces with addiction and addiction treatment.
I don't think athletes can get a fair shake in your typical treatment setting. I just don't think they can.
Well,
that's the underlying theme of what I'm talking
about.
Now,
when Doc was with us, I didn't feel like anybody.
No, they didn't.
Yeah.
Because it's a bunch of other self-obsessed celebrity freaks. I think that's what he thought. If I got there, maybe they wouldn't kiss my ass.
And he's really a lovely guy.
He is the most humble, good guy.
Yeah.
He came to get us. That's the other thing. So we were sitting in seats, Elvis and I, and I couldn't find him last night. Yeah. So after he played, he came into the stadium to get us, to bring us to where I thought I was going to meet Sandy Koufax, but I did not.
Only Bill Buckner.
Bill Buckner. I'm happy for Bill Buckner.
So as long as we got a few minutes by ourselves here, let's talk about the state of recovery and what's going on here.
It's awful. But one of the things I think about treatment, I believe addiction has morphed into a hybrid, almost like the flus have.
Flus?
The flu.
Like bugs have?
Yeah, like flu, yeah.
All right.
Yeah, isn't there new flus that can't be treated?
All the time. Treatment changes all the time.
Addicts nowadays are, because of the environment or whoever and because of who they are a new hybrid, and the rehab is not adequate to treat.
I mean, they're a hybrid of psychiatric trauma?
Yeah, psychiatric and inability to function in society. Mm. If you go to rehab when you're 20 and you haven't even moved out of your parents' house, there's a lot of stuff that has to be dealt with and talked about.
Yeah.
And these treatment centers are given the same treatment as if it's you or I walking in.
Well, that's my point. And that's the part that's been completely lost on people, which is this piece of needing to change everything in their life. They have
Or what about not change anything? Yeah, change where they live, but get a job.
But that's changing. Do things. They have to everything, when they get up, how they make their bed, what they do for a living, if they've ever had a living. Do they or don't they go to school? Who do they hang out with? Every single piece. And if you're making change like that,
you're going to succeed if you do that.
Well, but you need somebody with you every day helping support you through that. I couldn't do that. I'm not a drug addict. And I'm a drug addict? And people miss that that's where the sober community really steps in and supports and supports and supports and reinforces as you try to make these changes.
Do you think this generation of young people is less functioning than our generation?
Less functioning. Well, yeah, I think there's a bigger gap because, some kids, I mean, they are kicking each other's ass getting into schools.
3%.
Then there's a group way downstream that aren't getting out of bed because they either
10%.
Because they don't.
I'm saying the other 87% are really behind the curve.
But is it because it's getting so competitive?
It's because there's not a lot of opportunity and the way that we've prepared young people for the world has been wrong.
So we're telling them they're going to be
the super
Kardashians.
They're great. Yeah. They're great. They're great. No, you're not. Yeah. You're one of 6 billion.
Yeah.
And that, I think the addict needs to face that.
Mm.
You're one of 6 billion. That got through to me. I'm one of 6 billion. Oh, my God.
In prison.
Huh?
In prison that got through to you.
No, from 12-step people. Once I got sober.
Okay, so kicking a little
in
ass.
Order to, you know, get motivated, set some goals in life, do what adults do.
You take reality in reality's terms.
Yeah, you can't do that with this population.
What do you do?
You've got to go slow. Yeah. And like you say, you got to go over a year, year and a half, 2 year period of time, little by little, and monitoring all the time.
Right.
And there's no rehab for that. There's just me.
But people, right.
I have clients that I've been dealing with for 2 years.
No, that's right. And if you were their sponsor, technically that would be you too, right? I mean,
yeah.
A really good sponsor would do that kind of thing?
AA has kind of backed off and said, listen, we'll work through the steps. We're not here to run your life. Because it was too much of a burden. you know, in the last 10, 15 years of completely responsible for these people. Mm. So I've noticed that a lot of the 12-step language seems to be, listen, I'm here to help you work the steps. I'm not your mom. I'm not a cop. I'm not in charge of you. You make your own decisions in life. That standoffish approach is a response to the neediness of the population coming at the 12-step world.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I get that. But it doesn't it seem like that's the time to double down as opposed to back away?
Well,
or something else got to intervene, like with the services.
Well, I think there's an opinion that a lot of these kids aren't done yet. Done using it. You know that you and I had a partner that used to say that all the time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, that text you had me read a while ago before we went on the air, like, it's not done yet. It's all. Not the end of the world.
Is it that or what I see? We're talking about a kid that's very dysphoric and unhappy in 4 months into sobriety with a bunch of little relapses and saying now he's unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that just depression and the expression of the attachment problems we think really are at the core of addiction?
But you can't come to the – here's another thing about all the stuff we talk about.
Yeah.
Attachment disorder, all these kind of depression, dysthymia, all the things that this new hybrid of addict have, you can't deal with it until you have a productive life. I would say you can't. You don't get to just opt out of being responsible for yourself because you're depressed. See,
yeah,
this is the inner Republican in me coming
out.
Yeah,
but sometimes you're so depressed you can't do anything else.
That's not these kids. Come on.
Yeah, maybe.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
In fact, if they got jobs, if they became productive members of society, they'd be less depressed. That's
right.
My opinion.
I agree with that.
Right?
Yes.
Well, there are no jobs for them because they're not that high functioning.
Well, there's no jobs that are satisfactory to them. Do you remember the rehab guys, when I got them the jobs at Starbucks,
mm-hmm.
remember that? They had a Starbucks up the street from their sober living. What, six of them were living
and
there?
And you talked to the Starbucks. I remember that.
They said, I will hire three or four right now. Right, and I brought, I handed them the thing. I said, all you got to do is go online, fill this out, and go online. You have a job. Did one do it? No.
Nope.
Zero. Zero.
Well, so that, you know, you have to decide what's wrong with this. Why are we seeing so many young people die? I mean, 30,000 a year. Right?
What is it? Yeah, what is it?
It's their inability to function in society and go to school. Do you know how hard it is to go to school?
Yeah.
Hard.
Yeah.
Hard.
Yeah.
Right? I barely squeaked by at 38 years old, 36 years old.
And now it's super competitive, crazy competitive.
And it's, you know, so there's a lot in post-discharge from the rehab, a lot of obstacles that this clientele can't overcome, and the rehab centers are turning a blind eye to it. That's what I think. So,
well, they don't even try.
Yeah,
because how can you try? You just try to get them sobered up and in the program and back on their feet, and then what? What, they go back to school? They go back to what? I mean, what?
Nowhere.
Yeah, that's the part that's missing. But this is what you've been doing all these
years,
the last
been
couple
doing
years,
it.
Right? Yeah.
And it changes, and you got to be with the client to see which way it's going, and that 3 months later they have a different view of themselves and their capabilities, sometimes more clear and more honest and more, you know, reality-based.
Sometimes worse.
Some less. Remember when we told the client they had to have a job assignment, and he came to us and said, I'm going to be a lifeguard.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
I deal with that all the time.
Yeah.
And you just have to be loving and kind and say, okay, well, let's figure out, let's get some information about how you do that.
That's equivalent to saying I'm going to be an astronaut. it is. No, for some people.
Well, but you have to kind of be there for the person as they discover that option is maybe not the greatest. And then couple more months
of
sobriety.
But see, to me, that's a really good example of the attachment stuff that goes on. That's rapprochement. That's going out of the world, testing and bringing it back, and then being supported in a safe environment.
Somebody there to come back to.
Yeah.
And the way the model is now, 90 days of treatment, which is basically 90 days of nothing.
Yeah.
Right? Supervised nothingness.
Yeah.
Here's another interesting thing. You're the one that taught it to me, and I now repeat it all the time. Post-acute withdrawal
let's see what comes back at me.
post-acute withdrawal means you remember, you can't remember what you read, what you did
yesterday.
You still have
persistent symptoms.
You have some symptoms. But short-term memory loss. comes and goes, correct?
It just stays. Like,
okay.
Remember, you and I were going to talk to Sizemore.
So how come they're given so much information in the first 90 days when their brains don't work right?
Well, we used to struggle with that all the time, remember?
Oh, yeah.
And my co-director, Dr. Blum, with myself, would always just go, well, why do we bother with this? Let's just get them through the day.
Yeah, get through the day, get through the next available right action, and then – our idea was the 12-step world's going to pick it up right outside the doors here.
Well, we would say that, but it's repetition, repetition, repetition.
But
the
population of Chris Bohm, Chris Hoy, all the people that I got to with my generation, right?
Yep.
We're capable people. We know how to screw a screw gun into a wall. We know how to load furniture. We know how to get a job. We know how to schmooze. We know how to get by and survive in this world.
Yes.
The majority generation of people in treatment these days don't have those skills.
Well, is that because people feel the available jobs are somehow beneath them?
Yes, sometimes. Yes, definitely. Beneath their parents having a child that does that.
Right, which is a lot of it. The parents don't want that. And versus they've not been exposed to it. They may not know. They might really understand what that is. So is that because this is a more upper middle disease now?
But no, but I've dealt with the lowest of economic backgrounds, and they're just as arrogant.
Yeah.
And just, so it's a weird... So when treatment is under attack, like you've been feeling, the population has changed and treatment has not. So it's less effective than ever.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
So I want a new model that looks at a year and a half.
Who's going to pay for that?
Where the treatment plan update.
I totally agree. But of course, who's going to pay for that?
The treatment plan update shouldn't be until the 90-day point. How about that? If you break down just do the chart the way we used to do it in 30 or 60 or 90 days over 6 months, a year and a half.
Yeah, of course.
That's what needs to happen.
And that's sort of what you're doing, right?
Yeah, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
It's less expensive.
Right.
You just do it right.
You follow them in the world. It's more like living sober rather than sober living.
But the hard hit is the 30, 40 grand for the first 90 days. That's worth so much money up front, then long term people don't look. Somebody needs to build a treatment center. Hey, we've got a new career for Dr. Drew.
What's that?
We'll get Adam's money and we'll start a rehab the way it's supposed to be done.
But who's going to pay for the patient's treatment is the problem.
Oh, that's right.
Adam insists on making money. Hey, look at those guys. Chris and Gary are nodding their heads like, yeah, oh, yeah. All right, listen. The great Bob Forrest is with me. We're going to take a break, and we've got Doc Dwight Gooden in here. Does he like Dwight Gooden or Doc Gooden better?
Dwight.
I like Dwight Gooden.
Dwight.
All right, back to Dwight Gooden after this.
Hey, it's time to remind you guys again about our friends at Lumosity.com. Of course, you all work hard to stay in shape, eat right, go to the gym. But what about keeping your brain fit? We have to keep our brains healthy, too. You want to stay sharp, focused at work. That is why Lumosity.com is there for you. It gives you quick daily online workouts. They base this on the science of neuroplasticity. Lumosity.com's breakthrough online games give your brain the workout it needs to become sharper, better problem solver, even improve your memory. And they are personalized to meet your goals. That's right. You set up specifically what it is you want to work on, and then the website gives you feedback as to how your progress is going. I know I use a couple games I like a lot, and I'll use them even just randomly before, say, a program to get my focus, and I do them on a regular basis as well. I particularly like the Memory Matrix, which is sort of a card flip game, very challenging, and the Chalkboard Challenge, computation very quick with a rapid reaction time attached to it. Lumosity.com, here's what I suggest you do. Head on over to Lumosity.com today. Click on Start Training to begin training for free. That's right, free at Lumosity.com, and tell them you heard it from me, Dr. Drew.
Bob just asking what that model would be called. I call it treatment.
No, we got to come up with a fancy title for it.
Like those groovy tunes? You're a musician.
I know. I heard this last time. It's great stuff.
All right, listen, we got great Dwight Gooden coming in here in just a second. Bob Forrest with me, and Bob and I worked a lot with Dwight on Celebrity Rehab, and Bob has been in contact with Dwight up until last night.
Yeah.
And I've not seen Doc since he left, I don't think. Maybe once.
Oh, he's doing great.
Yeah. So let's bring him on in here.
Where's Dwight Gooden? There he is.
Oh, my God. He's
Are you in a suit and tie? What, are you coming from a funeral?
What's up, buddy? So you can't dress up a turd, right? Hey, how you doing, buddy?
Dwight Gooden all dressed up in a suit.
Have a seat. Okay.
Okay. And man, you look.
Only, yeah, right
you
there.
Look
and
healthy.
There's your headphones there.
You look like
look
literally.
At him.
Last time
look
I saw
at him.
You, I know, man. It's like 15 years, maybe 20 years younger.
20 years younger. Thank
yeah,
you. I appreciate
good
it.
Good for you. Yeah, congratulations. Well. Look like you. Your son.
My son. There you go. He looks wow. older now. He's got the long dreads. But he's doing pretty good.
Is he? Well, let's start talking about it. So you're here with us. Put those headphones on and join us.
Why are you all dressed up? Where did you come from?
I'm trying to impress Dr. Drew.
You had a signing.
Definitely.
You had a signing or something.
Yeah, had
it
a
really
signing.
Is good to see you. It really is. And so your son, the same son that we met?
Yeah, same son that you met.
Tell us about him. What's he doing?
He's actually
now?
Doing good. Dwight Jr., I saw him at my book release party last Tuesday, and he was there for a little bit. And then he had to head to Texas, San Antonio. He's actually an agent now. Where he's representing minor league baseball players.
That's
so
huge.
He's been doing great.
Good for him. My sense of your...
Look at him. Just take know, it in I, for a second. Listen. I told you he was doing good.
And that's how you can tell sometimes across the room.
Across
you know
the room.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes. When you were late, where he's like, oh, my God, he's out smoking crack.
No, I did not do that. I did not. That's you. That's your junkie just hand.
Just no, I found defensive. defending.
I guess it was an oil spill.
On yeah, the
freeway.
Yeah, yeah.
On the freeway, yeah. So I was like,
don't worry, Bob and I were just shooting the shit.
Yeah,
waiting for
well, I'm kind of used to it. You know, the traffic's like that in New York as well, so it's like the same type of deal.
I want to go back to something you said to me when you first got Celebrity Rehab that you had wanted for like 2 years. You said, I want to be on there. I think those guys could help me, right?
Yes.
Why did you think that?
Well, what I thought was I was always a big fan of the show, always talked about it, and the thing that really got me going was, unfortunately, being a public figure, I was always in denial or I would tell half the truth about my recovery. And for me to say I'm an addict or I have this disease of alcohol and drugs was tough for me and deceptive. And I thought by being on the show, not only to work with you guys, but to come clean and admit that, most of it for myself, to hear myself
see
say
that?
It.
That's what my sense was, that you really had a lot of shame you were carrying around with it.
When you went
both for the public and for your son. And you did both of them. Like, you really came out on both, right?
Yeah, coming out with both. Yeah. And obviously, putting the work in, and it was just a point in my life where it was just time. You know, I was just tired of living like that. You know, you're as sick as your secrets. And I just had to come clean with everything. And this show really helped me, and everything is going great. So yeah. A lot of things go to you guys to jumpstart my recovery.
Well,
you had to seek it out. You had to want it.
Yeah, you were
and,
nothing
and
but
they, a, but, you had a lot of people telling you you shouldn't do it, too, and you did it anyways. And that's something that took guts.
That was a big plus for myself because, like you just mentioned, people telling me you shouldn't do it. Most of my life been about people-pleasing. And that's what really kept me sick, you know, making others happy when it was hurting myself and killing myself. So there's a point in your life where you got to make decisions what's going to help you. And by helping me, I was able to help my family, reestablish my relationship with my kids, and just become a better man all the way around.
But maybe you don't know, but for us, you and somebody like you is a dream to treat because you came ready and locked, like ready to roll. You're ready to let's get going. Like, let's get treatment going here as opposed to being, you know, sort of maneuvering and telling half-truths, like you say. You were just like, just man, show me what to do, and I'll do it. And you did.
And I want to get to something that we were talking about before. When you went to all those rehabs, did everybody kiss your ass when you went there?
You know what? That's a great thing to bring up. You know, let me tell you why. Because the first rehab I went to in 87, you know.
Oh, my God, when you're Smith king of the world.
Yeah, I go to rehab, and obviously I still was in denial. I still was marking days off the calendar for the 30 days.
Yeah.
And plus, they was bringing me newspapers in. You know, I was getting food out. So it was a situation where
special treatment,
special treatment, and plus I wasn't ready.
Yeah.
So it was a little
situation.
Did you
have to go to groups?
I had to go to groups.
Really?
But now I must admit, in 94, when I was at Betty Ford, that was kind of optional.
Groups were optional?
Groups were optional. That was, I was looking at Betty Ford.
Dr. Drew's going to get
and I'm not bashing Betty Ford treatment center, but it was optional. I felt that place was more like a place where everybody went to kind of dry out, basically.
I thought it's where they went to get real treatment.
I'm telling
you. They have real
not
treatment.
Not in 94. They have real treatment, but in 94 it was different. I was there with a lot of people that was in the limelight, and it seemed like it was more of a drought place.
Hiding out.
Anything.
You know, where we used to work, Los Encinas Hospital, that was its original sort of—
from the 20s and 30s and 40s.
The W.C. Fields died there.
Raymond Chandler was there.
Yeah.
Was there? Yeah.
And they'd go there and they'd just dry out, but they would get like TLC. They'd get a little bit of like psychotherapy in the morning or something.
They get
the
test, looking at the ink blots as what Raymond Chandler talked about.
They'd
so what's that chart?
Rorschachs.
Rorschach,
worthless.
It was tough. And I tell you what, though, when I came to Celebrity Rehab, you know, what was great with me, you guys called it straight. When they hear you guys say, you know, you're going to die, to hear those words, even though you're aware of those things, but when somebody tell you that, unless you change your lifestyle, you're going to die, you know it's time to change your life. Or because I've been to prison, I've been to jail, I've been to rehabs, the only thing I haven't done was bent to a cemetery, and I don't want to do that. So it was a time in my life where I was ready to make the change.
It seemed like your relationship with your son was a big, big piece of this. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah,
it was very moving for me to see you guys like come together. Like, you came right together too. It was nice.
That was a big plus for myself. And thank you guys again for having him on the show, because I was able to clear it out with him. A lot of times, you know, you carry that shame and guilt around.
Yeah.
And basically, all it is, you know, it's a reservation to go back out and use. With him, it was a lot of guilt and shame because, as I talked about before and as I talk about in my book, was we always had dreams about hopefully playing professional baseball together. Unfortunately, in 2005, we was locked up together. And that was a painful thing, you know, to go through as a parent. And plus, when your kids look up to you, to carry that around. And I never really apologized to him about that and let him know how I felt and the pain that I caused. And to see him get real emotional over that, it was painful, but it was something I needed to see. And since that day we was on the show, our relationship couldn't have been any better. It's open. If he think I'm kind of getting off track a little bit, you know, he'll call me on it as he make the promise to you guys, which is great, and I respect him for that. And the same thing goes for him.
That's hard, man. For a son to be able to do that, that's tough work. That's good for him.
Yes, it's good for
him. It's good for you more than that. I guess better than good for him is good for you.
Yes, definitely.
He's a good guy.
Yeah, he's a great guy. Very caring guy and just really fond of himself now.
And if I remember right, I remember the forgiveness he felt immediately, but his main concern was you getting well, wasn't it?
That's his main thing. And that was his fear of him. Like when he lived with me in 2010 for a little bit in New Jersey.
I remember that story.
When he left for Thanksgiving, say he'll be back, and he didn't come back because he was tired of seeing me living like that. And I can only imagine, you know, watching your parent basically suffering and dying, slow death. So I understand. And so for now, like you say, for him to be open with me when he thinks something's wrong or if he hadn't heard from me in a little while, just to kind of check in a little bit. It says a lot for him to step up like that and to do that.
I got to tell you, I'm having an experience here.
Awesome, man.
Very emotional. Because I'm having these vivid moments. I remember you guys. I remember that story about him in Jersey and what he said about it. I remember him telling you about it. Yeah. I remember you guys at the picnic like 3 days later, though, you know, when that – didn't we have a fight?
Oh, yeah, the fight. Yeah, yeah. That was
but I remember him and you were like, you didn't give a shit. You guys were together.
Oh, like, yeah. And that's what he was saying. He said, that happens every day back home.
You guys like, hey, we're happy, man. We're together.
Who was the fight? I remember that.
That was it was Amy Fisher's husband, I think.
Yeah.
I forget his name.
And Jeremy.
And Jeremy.
And Jeremy, yeah. Jeremy Jackson.
That was pretty amazing.
It was over something, spilled milk or something.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Man, it's good to see you.
It's always good to see you guys, man. And as we was driving in here, it brings back good memories. I remember the Starbucks right there on, I think it's Glen Oaks.
Yeah.
I remember we stopped there in the van before we was going out on the event. And it's a good reminders, though. It's great reminders. And this way it all really started for myself. It's
like it did.
Getting a new birth. Yes.
Definitely. Awesome.
How was it in the – you did an outpatient program after we left you. How was that program?
Outpatient was great. When I first went there, my disease was still trying to fight me and tell me, find another place. You don't need this place. And part of it was because when I got there, they let me know right away, you're in here for one reason, to get better. If you're not here to get better, then you can go somewhere else. And so right away my dude was like, I don't think this place is for me. But I stuck it out. You know, I was there for a year. Then I did the one-on-one counseling there as well. And
wow.
I stayed in contact with a lot of counselors there.
Well, this is what we were just talking about before you got here, about how the whole process, you can get things started in a few months, but it takes a good year to get things really rocking. Don't you agree?
I totally agree because my track record has always been I'll get a little clean time, and then all of a sudden I say, well, I got it from here.
Yeah.
Then I'll continue to get the same results, bad results, when I try to do it myself. This time I stuck it out. And even though when they told me you got to be in the outpatient for a year, I said, man, a year. But that year goes by so quick. And if you don't get the tools from those places, you're in trouble. It's a waste of time.
And the healing, too. Your brain's got to heal a bit. Yes. Is that chronicled in the memoir?
I think so, yes, definitely. Yeah. The brain's got to heal. And it took a long time. And a lot of times you don't realize the damage you've caused. And one of the main things I got out of that was, like with the bills and the bills you didn't pay, it wasn't a big deal when you're active in your addiction. When you clean up and then you look at all the damage you've caused – and cause others, and you got to clean that stuff up slowly.
Well, now this is exactly what we were talking about. We before you got here, we were saying, you know, too much these days, the treatment is all about, oh, it's just the first 90 days or whatever. But your whole life has to be rejiggered, reworked. Everything's got to be reworked, and that takes time.
Yes, I totally agree. It takes time for that, and you're adjusting to everything, and dealing with whether it's problems with the kids in school or whatever it might be, you're dealing with it sober, so the feelings are different. You know, you really feel now, and then the damage you've caused and the trust you lost with family members, you get that back, but on their term. You can't force that back, and that's one of the things I'm learning as well.
Acceptance.
That's good.
There you go, man.
No, no, I can go home now.
awesome.
But I'm wondering if Dwight has insight, Bobby, into sort of what we're dealing with these days. I mean, sort of recovery is under attack, and treatment is getting
it just needs to be longer, and it needs to be more qualitative. That's all.
Less medicine, maybe, or different kinds of medicine. I don't know.
It's a lot of stuff going on, and I must admit, I've been following stuff where I guess passing recovery center, you guys was taking a beating for the deaths on it. It's truly unfair because, as you guys know, what you get out of recovery is what you put in it. You know, and I've seen the work you guys put in, and the work I've got from it definitely changed my life. So I've seen that.
Yeah.
And so for the stuff you guys been getting is definitely unfair. You know, a lot of that stuff is like you mentioned. When we leave here, it's up to us to use what we got here, but to continue. It's a day-to-day thing for the rest of our life.
Yeah, I realized when I was thinking about all this, I realized for my piece of treatment, the part I participate in, and we used to know this when we ran it at a hospital setting, it's like I felt like I'm like a chest surgeon or something. I'm getting them when they're really sick and putting them back together. Right. And then I hand them over to their doctor and go, well, anytime you need me, I'm here. But that's not the work I do. I do the sick stuff up front.
Yes.
And that people don't get how that is. But neither do the patients, though, I think, sometimes. They don't understand that they got to keep going the way you did. I mean, exactly what you did.
Yeah, the patient, we had to keep going. And myself was I've been
it
beat
the
down
fifth
so many
one?
Times.
What was celebrity rehab, the fifth rehab you've been in?
Yes, the fifth one.
See, that's what national statistics say. Maybe it takes four failures to figure out, like, hey, this is not over after a month or two.
That's true. And my thing was, as you mentioned, a lot of people think once you got a rehab, you're fine now.
Well, you
thought
that.
It's just the beginning. I did thought that many times. I said, you're right. I think that you're fine now. But, no, your work really begins when you get
out.
Wait,
go back to the original thought you had. After the first rehab, you thought, well, alcohol is not illegal.
Oh. Yeah, alcohol is legal. And then plus at that time, you're thinking 21 and they're telling me I can't drink no more the rest of my life.
Right. That's
hard.
That.
Thinking that. And it's hard. Instead of just thinking, get through the day or get through this 5 minutes, whatever it takes. Or however.
Look at that.
You know, you got to do it.
No,
How do you implant what he's saying into people? It's impossible.
I know it's impossible. Yeah. If I could just get people to commit to a year of treatment.
Yeah.
That'd be the piece that's missing for me. And then not to get screwed up by too many medications along the way, because you easily get off track. My peers will take you off track. Yeah.
That's another thing I learned, too. Like you say, getting patients to commit to a year. Yeah. Everybody thinks 28 days,
no.
30 days is not enough.
No, no.
Mostly, I think they come up with those numbers probably because of insurance companies.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. 100%. Listen, when we worked in a hospital setting, we were lucky we had 5 days, 7 days.
Yeah. Because I had to realize that, off and on using drugs for over 20 years, going to treatment for 30 days is not going to fix me.
There you go.
Being committed a year is not going to fix me.
It could turn you around and point you in the right direction. I always sort of looked at it that way. Like, let's get you going in that direction.
I agree.
Yeah.
I totally agree with that.
Is there a way that we could have gotten to you with that information the second or third treatment? And let me just preface this by saying that we worked with people that would say categorically no, people have to be ready on their own terms. But I think
people are ready repeatedly. It's just a matter of when, let me say this. The year you did was because of MLB, right?
The first year, yes.
This outpatient.
The outpatient?
Yeah.
No.
How long did they insist you do it?
When I was here?
No, for the outpatient in New York.
Oh, after I left here?
How long did they say you had to do it?
No, that was nothing to do with MLB. The court system basically wanted me to come here. Once I finished here, I could have said I'm just going to AA or NA, but I just knew I needed more. From like you mentioned, the four previous treatments didn't work because I wasn't ready. And then,
I thought there was something saying you had to be in some sort of outpatient for a couple months. What was it?
Well, it was here with the court system when I got in trouble in 2010.
The court was out here?
Yes.
In California?
Here. Well, when I came here to sleep rehab, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that 2010? Oh, my God.
2011, seriously? I'm sorry.
Okay.
It was 2011.
Oh, yeah. You got in the trouble in 2010. You had to pay for it in 2011.
But I do remember having to write letters to the court that you were going to continue in an outpatient setting. They did want you to continue.
But for
somewhere.
How long did they say you should do it for? That's what I'm saying.
That was like 6 months to a year.
Okay.
6 months
but
to
what
a year.
What I did was just me not trusting myself. When I got there, I told the counsel, when you feel I'm ready to go back out there, then it's your call, not my call.
And then how long did the court until they made it, until it all went away?
Probably,
6 months?
Yeah, 6 months after I was there, and then I just stayed on another, 8 months.
Wow.
Doing it, so.
See what I'm saying?
Because
we're trying to build a better mousetrap, Doc, and we don't know how, and we're going to use the guinea pig of success.
Not the guinea pig. you guys
are doing
the
job.
The exemplar.
You guys are doing a job. It's just where you say
it's
just about acceptance.
It's under attack. Everything's under attack right now, and I don't know. It's
It's more attuned discouraging. Treatment for a longer period of time. But you still have to have a willing patient.
Yes.
Yeah, I would even argue that you, even with a not so willing patient, you could get somewhere.
Yeah.
I think so. That's because when you guys asked me earlier, if you'd have caught me on a second or third treatment,
yeah,
would I have got it?
Yeah.
I think so, because when I was here, we hit on some core issues that I never dealt with that was keeping me, you know, see, with the shame, the guilt.
Yeah.
I want to believe that. I want to believe that done skillfully, if we help patients properly, Bob, if we are, as clinicians, not just you and I, but my peers, are skillful with how we approach patients and become more skillful with time, there'll be less need for patients to be, so to speak, ready. We'll make them. We'll get them there.
I think that's
another piece that's missing.
None of the other treatments really poked you with a stick about your son and your kids?
Never touched that, and I've talked about it a lot of times, but never really touched that. And the main thing, when I remember you asked me about if I ever experienced any type of trauma when I was a kid. And I wasn't aware that watching my sister get shot and left for dead was trauma, and how I hid in the bathroom and how it coincided with when I used to get high, I used to go in the bathroom, whether it was at home, apartment, restaurant or what have you, and it
going to
the bathroom. And the guilt and shame of my kids was a major one.
Heavy trauma.
Poke them with a stick.
And then that trauma never gets processed. Did you work on the trauma later in that 1 year the outpatient treatment?
Yes. They had a grieving thing where I went there, and I actually teared up talking about it, which I thought that stuff was all over and gone, but just kind of reliving that moment, even though at that time.
With your sister?
Yes. I was 5 years old, because even, I think it was more so the state she's in now, where she's okay, but she still has a bullet in her head, where when that bullet moves, she has these seizures still.
Oof.
And so it was just kind of like when the grieving group, you're thinking about all that stuff, and you relive that moment. But it was healthy. It was healthy for myself.
There you go.
I get really emotional around Dwight.
Yeah.
Well, shining star.
Well, no, but he's a person, a human, really a human being, you know. It's all there.
He was there. He was this lost soul.
Lost soul, yeah, and just... Like I said, it was in denial and just trying to find myself.
Then I get angry at anybody that gave him shit back when he was in his disease. And this poor Dwight was struggling. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not. You know what I mean?
I'm sure Dwight could be arrogant once in a while back in the 80s.
In the 80s, yeah. But obviously, I wish I could have been, I wouldn't say more arrogant, but more outspoken on what was really going on inside of me.
Oh, yeah.
And that was one of the things that were keeping me sick and not really telling people who I really am and trying to live up to others' expectations.
Let's just relive, say, 1987. You're walking into a restaurant and there's a line. Does Dwight stop at the line?
No. No, not then, but no, you just keep going.
That's
because
right
of 86, you go right up front, yeah. I mean, all that was great, but at the same time, a lot of times, like the restaurants and all the people, they didn't have your best interest. And what I mean by that,
they
didn't care.
They didn't care, but like
you mentioned, were a cartoon. Yeah.
After 86, they give you get cars, you get the free meals, but then like in 88, when the playoffs start with the Dodgers, now you get those calls, hey, can you get us some tickets? So, you know, everything
switch
changed.
Around?
Yes. Can you get us in the clubhouse? Everything changed at that time. So it was always like a motive.
How's the book been? How's it selling? How's people receiving it? Tell us about it.
You know, the book's going great. The book was great therapy for myself. It was kind of like a follow-up when I left Celebrity Rehab, because now I can tell my story and be comfortable with it and be comfortable with my own skin, where before I would tell...
You were worried?
I was worried how people were going to accept me. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, as I mentioned earlier, that was what was keeping me sick. So now it's the matter of doing this for myself first, getting all this stuff out and being a public figure. I figured, you know, putting it in a book would be the right thing, and I was at a good place to do that. And not only did it help myself, but helping others. The feedback's been great, and the sales been going pretty well. It hit the stores June 4th.
With Amazon. Just started, yes. So go get it. Everyone that's listening to this podcast, all the Corolla Pirate Ship supporters,
Go to Amazon.
Doc, a memoir. It'll be up on doctor.com?
Right.
For sure. I want people to listen very carefully to what Doc was just saying about telling his story. When we talk about people getting well, we talk about being able to make sense of your life or create a cohesive narrative out of your life.
Yeah.
And so to the extent that, you know, writing it down is formally creating that narrative, there it is, man. And then that's why it's therapeutic.
What about when you're editing it and you're reading it?
It's
freaky,
reading,
right?
It's almost like doing
it's
the steps.
So
like doing
freaky.
When you're doing the 12 steps, because you're doing stuff and the writing is powerful. And you're putting that stuff on paper and you're reliving it. So, I mean, it was the times where I would literally break down crying, and then those times where you're like, man, did I really do this? And then some stuff you laugh at and some stuff you get real happy about for your career or whatever. So there's a lot of that stuff in there. But basically, it was like doing the 12 steps.
Yeah. And I just did it, too. And it just some of it I know has to be in there, but I'm still like this about it, right?
Yeah. Some of it, that's just kind of like, you're right. Some
honest,
of it, you're like, I don't want to put this.
Like,
you got to do it. And it kind of reminded me of, like, when I first was trying to get clean, I didn't want to change my lifestyle. You know, I still want to go to clubs. I still want to go to certain places, knowing where it's going to lead to. Because the alcohol is there. The drugs are there. So you know how it is. You got to change everything. And that was one of the difficult things for myself as well.
Your book's out?
No, it's coming out. It's October.
Reminded Bob has the movie, Bob and the Monster. It is so good. We can get.
Oh, it's awesome.
Is out? Wait, is that out now or is that?
It's out in September.
The book, the movie.
The movie's
the book?
In September, and the book is on October.
Oh, we got to put that book is the. This is required viewing for these guys, Bob and the Monster. So that's out in September?
Yeah.
Why the delay?
Because I don't know why. You know some company that specializes in 12-step based material bought it so that I can't even go to a rehab and screen it. And
oh, geez.
Isn't that weird? There's so many companies in this world.
Companies, yeah.
Because I wanted a copy of it to go to a rehab a friend of mine has.
Oh,
I was
yeah.
like, I'm just going to screen it and whatever. And they're like, oh, well, you have to call this person. And I'm like,
oh, my God. Let's take a call, guys. Gentlemen, let's take a call. We have somebody. Yeah. I don't know. There's John. John's in Fresno. John, what's up?
Dr. Drew?
Hey, John. You're on with Bob Forrest and the great Dwight Gooden.
Bob, Doc, quite a pleasure, of course. I called you a couple weeks ago, Doctor, about the Valium withdrawal.
Yes.
And I pretty much tackled it. I think it was pretty rough.
You sound a lot better. Let me remind people. You were 3 days into, 4 days into a Valium withdrawal on Suboxone, too, right?
Yeah, I'm actually 2 days off that right now. That's why I called.
Good for you. That's going to be a rough. That's going to be even rougher, I'm afraid. You all right?
Well, you know, I'm kind of like crawling out of my skin with the Valium, how it was with that too, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a weird feeling because you can't just crawl out of your skin and be comfortable. You know, you're stuck. So, I mean, I'm at the beach right now. So, I mean, maybe that's why I'm a little happy because it's 110 in Fresno. So I'm not there for that. But, I was just wondering, with the Valium, it was kind of surprising because it came out of nowhere about, like you said, 5 or 6 days after I stopped. And with the subs, like, I'm kind of looking at it right now, like, it's been 2 days, and I'm feeling a little bit something, but I don't know what I'm supposed to expect when.
Right. John, these things can be very unpredictable, but it's not uncommon for it to be a rocky couple of weeks. Yeah. On, off, at certain times of day, really bad. Other times of day, not so bad. A lot of sleeplessness, a lot of aches and pains and creepy skin, sense of desperation. The fact that you're barreling through this is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Can I ask, John, why did you get on those two drugs to begin with?
Hey, Bob, it's quite a pleasure. I'm a musician, too, so I always like hearing what you say about all that. My doctor actually prescribed me Valium and Suboxone because I was on Vicodin for about 3 years.
Vicodin's easier to get off of.
I know.
Do you know that? Did you know that when he told you? That Vicodin's easier to get off of than Valium or Suboxone.
You're right.
It's crazy.
I had to learn that, you know, but I wish
your doctor knew that.
Yeah, but the plan is when they start, this is where they don't understand dealing with addiction. Their plan is, I'm going to put you on Suboxone and Valium. We're going to taper them off over the next 5 days. You start taping the guy off, and John calls like, hey, shit, we aren't going through this, man. What can you do for me? And he goes, just stay on the Valium and Suboxone. Just stay the course. It'll be fine. It's your replacement drug. You can stay on it as long as you want.
Yeah.
And now you're done. Now you're toast.
Yeah.
So that's how it happens.
You don't even get high from Suboxone. Why? How long have you been on it for?
Oh, man. I was on it for about 2 years.
I'm
not going to lie. I smoke pot, too. I'm not going to lie. So
well, it sounds like you're smoking. I hear the pot even now. Are you using that to try to treat the withdrawal?
Using the pot to treat with the withdrawal.
Well, I mean, as you know, like, there's so many symptoms, whether it was Valium or Suboxone, and
Just answer the question, John.
John, you're at the beach high on pot right now.
No, I can hear that it was high. But listen, he's using that
to get
off.
You're going in the right direction, John.
He's using that to get off the other stuff. Okay.
I need to hear that because you never know what direction you're headed in, you know.
Well, Suboxone's an awful drug. It's a dead-end drug. I'll say that.
What is?
You know the guy that wrote the book Beautiful Boy?
Yeah.
His son is on Suboxone and thriving, according to David Sheff.
I loved that podcast. That was so good.
It was interesting. David's a great guy, but his son.
The guy that was in prison, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, that was Brandon Stogsdale. He wrote a book. You can get his book. He's got the whole thing. Yeah, you've been to Brandon, haven't you?
What is thriving?
Well, I know, I understand. but he's convinced. Listen, it's not what I.
Hey, VH1 and playing in the MLB is thriving.
Well, but we're talking about this guy's son, David Sheff's son, and for me or you or Doc, we would not consider that thriving, nor would I want that for any of us. But some people feel like that's better than the. I don't judge this. I just have a philosophy that I think is better. For most, I would want it for people.
Well, he and I were on drugs for many years and accomplished a few things.
On
you
drugs?
Could say we were thriving doing coke and heroin and drinking. I was doing heroin. You weren't. I'm sure that's not allowed in baseball.
Baseball, yeah.
Damn.
But,
yeah, we'll get to
but
that
the point you. Being, okay, he's on a drug and he's doing some good things once in a while. But long term.
It's not the way to live, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I just but it's better than dying, and that's sort of the way they look at it. And they don't feel that they could do it any other way. I don't – listen, not my patient, not my situation.
Suboxone sucks. I can say it.
I'm grateful for you guys and your recovery and the state you're in. And Doc is an inspiration. He was an inspiration when he was hang on a second. Okay. Doc, to me, was an inspiration when I first met him. You know what I mean? You know why? Oh, I don't know if I can put words
in this. I know exactly why. I just love him. Because I was scared to death of him. There were so many bad things about him, and he was the most vicious monster on the mound. You just look at him and go, that guy's killed people before. Yeah. And then you meet him, and he's the sweetest guy in the world. Well, that interests me.
It's interesting. I didn't have all that kind of preconceived conceptions about him.
You never see his glare from the mound in 1986?
No, it's bullshit. I know that.
Give it to him now.
No, I know. Did you see it last night when he was pitching?
Did you watch that last night?
No, you didn't.
That brought me some good memories last night.
You were just throwing fastballs.
Just throwing it easy, yeah.
But Mickey Hatcher up against him is just pathetic.
I know. But he got a hit. Mickey Hatcher got a hit, yeah.
But he was not afraid to be – it's the only way I can describe this, to be a human being. He came with his shame right along into the room with him. You know what I mean? It was like right in front, like in a bag. Like, here's my shame, man. I'm ready to like let it all happen right here. And that's brave and that's courageous and it's human. It's a human thing. We all have some of that stuff.
Yeah, that's basically what you want. Even though, unfortunately, like being in the limelight with my baseball career, they kind of made it impossible for you to be yourself. But unfortunately, I would medicate myself when the pain was really hurting. But when I came here, it was just a point, you know, we just get sick and tired of living like that. And you know you're dying if you don't do something about it and do it quick.
Well, we have to wrap this experience up here. Do you have any parting words? Get the book for sure. Doc, a memoir. Anything else you want people to know about you or your experience? Or
I think the main thing, obviously get the book. I tell basically my life story in the book. But one thing is... I can't thank you guys enough. I know I keep saying that, and I'm not saying that because you guys are here. I even said when I'm in New York, you guys jump-started my life, got my life on the right path, and I can't thank you enough. And things are going great, but at the same time, I know if I let my guard down, what can happen. But I'm just doing what you guys gave me here, the tools you gave me to use to help myself, number one, and to help others, you know, by leading by example.
I appreciate your gratitude, but you need to know that it is our privilege. It's our pleasure. It's why we do this work. I get emotional just –
I'm it's glad just, you guys are in this business because it meant a great deal not only to myself but my family, and I have a relationship with my kids today that
it's
I have.
Say hi to your son for me. He's a great guy. So.
I will. Definitely.
All right. That will do it for this podcast. To great Dwight Gooden, a memoir available at Amazon. Also, check out his Twitter at Doc Gooden, GOODEN16. Bob, you want to say anything about what's coming up with you?
Trust God, clean house.
BobandTheMonster.com. You can hear about the movie that is so fantastic about Bob. There's a whole story about Bob that no one knows, not even you two behind the glass.
I'm wearing my Hershiser jersey in one of the scenes.
Are you? I got to check it out.
All right, we'll see you next time.
This is Corolla Digital.